So I've always been a bit of a market structure geek. And so I really had a lot of fun doing this podcast today with Michael Feng, the founder and CEO of Hummingbot, which we'll find out more in the podcast episode. I love the idea of decentralizing the market maker function. Traditionally, market making has been highly institutionalized, kind of a Wall Street boys club. Of course, hedge funds and stat arb trading desks have broken this down a bit and deployed their own highly sophisticated strategies that operate at scale and are very capital intensive. Projects like Hummingbot give a bit of the edge back to smaller traders and also improve markets by narrowing spreads on issues. This is an example of letting 100 flowers bloom and seeing how trading ingenuity can democratize algorithms for trading and provide a market stabilizing function at the same time. So I hope you really enjoyed this podcast. If you like it online, share it with people you know. I think you'll enjoy it, particularly if you're a market structure geek like I am. So with that, I bring you Michael Feng of Hummingbot. Welcome to The Encrypted Economy, a weekly podcast featuring discussions exploring the business, laws, regulation, security, and technologies relating to digital assets and data. I am Eric Hess, founder of Hess Legal Counsel. I've spent decades representing regulated exchanges, broker-dealers, investment advisors, and all matter of fintech companies for all things touching electronic trading with a focus on new and developing technologies. So really excited to have Michael Feng. He's the founder of Hummingbot on the podcast today. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Eric. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So for those of you who don't know, I'll actually allow you to introduce what Hummingbot is to the listener. And why don't we start off with your background story and then sort of roll into what Hummingbot is?
Sure. I graduated from college in 2001. I went to Wharton, business school at the University of Pennsylvania for undergrad. So I followed the herd of lemmings to Wall Street, like everyone did back in the day. So I actually worked in this area of finance called CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, which was an esoteric backwater when I first started. But over the next like about 5 or 6 years, became a pretty important part of the finance industry. Unfortunately, I had the privilege, I guess, if you will, of structuring the first CDO backed by subprime mortgages. This was called South Coast Funding, which launched in August 2013. But it kind of like set off a tidal wave of similar vehicles backed by all kinds of, you know, mortgages like residential, commercial. We threw like hedge fund, strategies in there, like high yield loans and bonds. And unfortunately, these securitized vehicles had a part in causing the 2008 financial crisis and were featured in the movie The Big Short. So,
And I left Lehman 1 month before the collapse. So, and for related reasons. So thank you very much, Michael. I didn't know that you were the one who was behind it all, but now I know the great market forces.
I was definitely not the one behind it all. I was basically the first year analyst who had some really good VBA skills in Excel. That they tapped to create the models for these things. So
when I was like, "What, you put me on this podcast to lionize me?"
Yeah, no. I would say, to be honest, I would say from that experience, it actually really just crushed me, because I did well financially, but after about 9 years of doing that, in 2010, I was just incredibly disillusioned by the 9 years I'd spent creating all kinds of really complicated products that frankly subtracted value from the economy, cost millions of people their homes and jobs. And I just felt I was this like unwitting participant to this huge debacle. And I felt like my career had frankly been wasted at that point. I actually remember I was working in Hong Kong at the time, was living in this like big, like, luxury condo and just feeling like, what's the point of all this? Why just continue? And so that's actually why I left finance. I ended up just applying to a master's, this like engineering degree, this program at Stanford. Luckily, I got in. And so I just like quit finance in 2010. And I thought I would never go back to the finance industry ever again. And I really just wanted to create tech products and do something related to engineering that would actually, add value to the world instead of subtracting from it.
Excellent. Yeah. So that led you to
to crypto, I guess. But yes.
Or I don't want to skip. There might be other parts of the story.
Yeah. I mean, the basically, you know, so I spent 2 years at Stanford, learning code. And then afterwards I was like, hey, let me try to find a job as an engineer in Silicon Valley. Unfortunately, my resume just said failed investment banker at the time. So I had a lot of trouble just getting even an interview at some of these tech startups. So you know, but the good part was I had taken a bunch of like Stanford courses in entrepreneurship, that, you know, one of these projects that you try to like create some kind of startup with your friends. And I just caught the bug. You know, I just felt like, hey, you know, why can't I do it too? So I decided to create a company. I created a startup. The idea was to, because I had spent a lot of time as an analyst in finance, like basically copying reports in PDF formats into Excel. And I was like, you know, and the one thing you learn in these startup classes is you always want to solve this like big pain point that people have, right? And from your own personal experience. So I was like, you know what? What if I could create a tool that just like automatically extracted tables from PDFs? I could save investment banking analysts everywhere like millions of myriad hours of like drudgerous work. So then I teamed up with my friend Max, who I'd gone to college with. He was a great engineer. He taught me a lot of like, you know, things on how to actually really code. And so we actually created this tool. It used computer vision. So the same heuristics that your human eye uses to detect lines and boxes and columns and stuff like that. And we created a tool called DocMunch that would basically, you could drag your cursor over this like table in a PDF and would basically copy that into Excel perfectly. That was nice. However, it was more of a product than a company. We had a lot of trouble figuring out how to monetize from that. I actually remember we had a contract with Citigroup to help them. And Citigroup was like, you know what? We can't really use your PDF tool because a lot of our reports now are in APIs. You know, we have APIs now, structured data. Where we really need help is a way to like take all these APIs and put them into a single dashboard that we can all consume. You know what I said? I said, that's not what we do. Our business is creating PDF tools. So, you know, you can find someone else to do that business for you. And we just want to keep on, you know, building and selling this PDF tool that we had created. So
that's not the future.
So honestly, it was actually a really good experience. I kind of learned like what being an entrepreneur actually is and what it's not. So long story short, we ran that business for about 3 years and we were acquired eventually by a company called Nitro that does PDF software. They make like an alternative to Adobe Acrobat.
I use Nitro.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So I became head of product.
I used to.
Yeah. So I became head of product at Nitro for a while. You know, they hired me, they put me in charge of like a 10-person team of like product managers and designers. And honestly, I had no idea what I was doing. I was like trying to be a manager really for the first time in my life. And while my co-founder was head of machine learning at Nitro. So we were both there for a couple of years. Honestly, we learned a lot in terms of how to operate in a medium-sized startup. But then, you know, in 2017, I was pretty tired of the PDF industry at that point. I felt I had knew everything I had known about, you know, all kinds of various PDF configurations and standards. And I was like, this is so fucking boring. I got to get out of here. So in 2017, that was also when the ICO.
What I loved about Nitro is because I use Nitro. Okay, I stumbled upon it. I'm a lawyer, and I would do a lot of these like documents and stuff. So I stumbled upon it, and I loved it because like I could break any PDF. Like if you put a control on it, you put something to limit it.
Yeah.
I could use Nitro to break it apart, convert it, and like no other tool really gave me that capability. So I use it for like everything. But I became like a diehard Nitro user. Oh, wow. I felt like it was it gave me functionality that I just couldn't get anywhere else. So I was just like, I was super stoked for a while. And then Adobe like started to like come out with better tools and stuff like that. So now, you know, and there's other integrations, but for a while there, for years, Nitro was the one that I used. I used it like incessantly.
Oh yeah. So thank you. Yeah.
I met the man behind it. So there you go.
I was just a product manager for a while for Nitro, but the real secret sauce for Nitro, honestly, is some of the engineers they have in Eastern Europe, who've been with the company for like, you know, 10 plus years and who are really like, you know, experts in the PDF spec. But today, you know, Nitro is still chugging along. They're a public company in Australia. I think they added e-signatures to the capabilities. And I'm just really happy that, like, you know, the folks who, you know, they take a chance on us, they acquired us. And, you know, even though I wasn't there for very long, I did learn a lot from Sam and the rest of the team in terms of just how to run a business. So I took that forward in 2017. That was when the first like ICO boom in crypto happened. And I think I just read this one article one day about, you know, I'd always known about crypto and blockchain and Bitcoin, but as an ex-finance person, I was super skeptical about it. They actually posted my Facebook from like 2013. And I was like, how do I find a way to short Bitcoin? You know, so luckily I didn't actually short Bitcoin in 2013, but I actually wanted to back in the day because I thought it was complete scam. But what happened was, I think in 2017, I read these articles about Ethereum and how you can use smart contracts to, you know, basically create programs on the blockchain that didn't require humans to be involved. And to me, coming from the finance world, you know, being parts of lots of like, you know, securitizations and creating lots of SPVs and all kinds of like, you know, basically, you know, very paper driven, you know, entities. I was captivated by the appeal of smart contracts. And so that's what led us to create a company called Coin Alpha, which is the company behind Hummingbot. I started it with two friends of mine, my friend Carlo, who I know from college, who was kind of had a similar background to me. But had studied computer science in school, so he was very technical. And also Martin, my friend who was working at Apple, who had basically built this kind of this machine learning, you know, trading algorithm, that he had created. So the three of us created Coin Alpha, and the original idea of Coin Alpha was to create a on-chain hedge fund. The idea was to basically take Martin's quant trading strategy and put it into a smart contract. And then allow anyone to be able to invest and redeem using a smart contract, using Ethereum, and skip all the cost of creating a vehicle, a hedge fund normally. Because today, if you try to create a hedge fund yourself using, you know, set up an SPV in the BVI, hire an administrator, a custodian, an auditor, you're probably running at like $100,000 plus of costs, you know, just to get set up. And before you can even, you know, actually start trading and raising capital. But even then, a lot of hedge funds, like it's like it takes like a month to get in and redeem. And honestly, it's just sort of, in my opinion, a lot of like useless paper pushing. And so what we want to do was create a smart contract that allowed anyone to just subscribe and redeem using Ethereum. And the way it worked is we were actually trading on Gemini and we had a bot, this algorithm that would automatically, you know, predict the price of Bitcoin using Martin's machine learning algorithm, and then would automatically place trades to switch between US dollar and Bitcoin automatically every 15 minutes, depending on the prediction that was made. And then the smart contract, it would pull the NAV using Oracle from Gemini into the smart contract, which would allow people to subscribe and redeem on a daily basis at NAV. And the smart contract calculated you know, the management fee, the performance fee, the high watermark, and all the variables used in accounting for a hedge fund.
Cool. And so then how did that switch over to Hummingbot?
That's a great question. So here's what happened. So the hedge fund part of the strategy actually did pretty well. I think we made something like 23% net of fees in a year when Bitcoin and Ethereum were like down, you know, a lot. This was 2018.
Nice.
So, however, what didn't work was actually convincing other hedge funds to adopt this protocol, because that was the original goal. And the reason was because we were targeting traditional hedge funds in equities world and the fixed income world. And I still remember this one hedge fund manager said to me, he said, this is a great idea. You know, this would save us a lot of like operational time and cost. However, if I told my LPs that I'm switching over our you know, administrator, from some like trusted third party to a smart contract, they're going to run for the hills because you know the last thing
I can't imagine
why. Yeah, no, I can't imagine why either. So he said the last thing my LPs want me to do is focus on like cost cutting when I should be focused on, you know, building a better strategy. And we heard that time and time again from other hedge funds as well. Meanwhile, I was out there at crypto conferences, you know, really pushing this fund protocol, as we called it. And one day I got a letter from the SEC and it said, you know, Securities Exchange Commission Enforcement Division. And the letter said, hey, it looks like you're doing something called general solicitation because you know, you issued a hedge fund, you registered using Rule 506B, which doesn't allow you to, doesn't allow hedge funds to solicit generally. But I see all these videos of you at conferences talking about this fund protocol. There's a contact form on your website. And you know, please come in and talk to us and tell us what happened. So at the time, we weren't that worried, actually, because we had hired Orrick, this great law firm, and we figured that Orrick would, you know, had given us good advice on how to set up the hedge fund, and they could help us, you know, resolve this misunderstanding with the SEC. So over the next 6 months, we flew to DC, you know, paid our Orrick lawyer, you know, $1,000 an hour to join us in those conversations. And we had lots of discussions with SEC. And after 6 months of all this, you know, and lots of legal costs, I think we had paid about $300K in legal fees at the time. The SEC said, you know, we know you guys didn't do anything wrong. You know, you weren't trying to do anything wrong, but you did have this contact form on your website. You did talk about this thing in conferences. We think we have a case here. So why don't we have you settle for $50,000? You know, this one of the smallest, you know, settlements ever, and please close down your fund. And so at that point, we had, yeah, because of the money we had spent and the prospect of dragging out in further litigation was incredibly unappealing. So we said, sounds good.
I can't imagine why.
Sounds good. And so we closed down our hedge fund.
Yeah, for $50,000, that's better than going back and forth one time with your attorneys, right?
Yeah, so. But honestly, this causes...
Can we do that without the attorneys?
Yeah, this causes a lot of heartache, honestly, because, you know, this also really distracted us from actually running a startup and do all these things. Luckily, at that point, we had already raised our seed round from Bain Capital Ventures, so we had, you know, more than $2.5 million in the bank. And so at that point, even though we had shut down the fund, and frankly, this fund protocol idea, you know, we knew it didn't really have any legs anyway. So we knew we had to pivot to something else. And so at the time, we just decided to open source our tech stack and just kind of like allow anyone to use this kind of like this technology software we had built that automated the running of an algorithm and the ability to place orders on the exchange and kind of like compute and just really manage that whole process. And the reason we open sourced it was because what we realized was a really big pain point we had was just integrating an automatic program, a process, you know, via WebSocket, which is a streaming kind of data connection interface with a cryptocurrency exchange's API. And the reason is because there were many exchanges, even back then, there were like dozens of cryptocurrency exchanges. Every exchange had a slightly different API. The documentation was very lacking. You know, even now, even today, a lot of exchanges are lacking in APIs. And so, but in order to actually trust that you could actually have this process running automatically, trading real money, it took us at least over a month of solid engineering time just to like build the integration, test it, and resolve all the different bugs and edge cases involved in that integration. And so what we found was, you know, this was like incredibly boring, like really just like soul sucking work from an engineering standpoint. But it was like, you had to do it before you could trade. And every single hedge fund, every single individual trader out there was doing the exact same thing. And so we had no idea how we would make money. Our VCs asked us this question, like, how are you guys going to make money off open sourcing this thing? And I honestly, like my answer was, I have no idea. But
volume.
Yeah. Well, but at that point, like after going through that whole SEC experience, you know, having spent a year creating this protocol that no one except for us wanted to use, just creating something useful was what we wanted to do. So we open sourced it, but then interestingly enough, we actually got paid a dev grant from ZeroX, one of the early decentralized exchanges, to add this strategy that they want us to create called basically cross exchange market making. Because the idea was they were creating this decentralized exchange, and this decentralized exchange had very little liquidity on the exchange. So we came up with a strategy where we created a bot that would use the order book from Binance which was a more popular centralized exchange, and it would use the information on the Binance order book, and it would basically mirror those orders on the 0x exchange order book. And so we call this cross-exchange market making, which is still one of the most popular strategies humming by today. And it's run by a lot of individuals. In this case, you're kind of like taking liquidity from a very liquid exchange with very tight spreads, and then you're basically remarketing that liquidity onto another exchange and posting wider spreads. And so because you're posting orders on the exchange, I can explain how this later. This is what you're acting as a market maker. You're not taking orders from the exchange. You're right. Basically providing orders on the order book. You're more kind of like offering that to more wider population. So the idea is that right. You know, you can use information on a very liquid exchange like Binance. When you post wider orders on the more less liquid exchange, if you're filled, your bot can automatically hedge on let's say the more liquid exchange at a tighter spread. And then what you're making is your arbitrage difference in the middle between the wider spreads posted on the small exchange versus the tighter spreads on the more liquid exchange. So we found a couple of things we found interesting. Number one, a lot of individuals were interested in running this because they had access to these small exchanges that maybe due to geographic reasons or because of the blockchain aren't available to the wider trading firm population. But the second thing that was interesting was we found that exchanges themselves were really interested in this because a lot of small exchanges, let's say you're starting exchange yourself, how do you actually provide liquidity? How do you ensure that your order book has sufficient depth for people to come and trade? They have to run some type of algorithm themselves to do that. And so, when we kind of came out, there was no other tool available open source that allowed people to do this. And so we found a lot of our early users were the smaller exchanges themselves.
Oh, wow. So the idea of doing a wider spread is really just to build out a depth of book, not to present the most competitive spread, because that's on Binance.
Right.
But if you want to post liquidity, if you're trying to encourage that kind of liquidity, you're trying to provide that depth of book, at least you can provide the wide basis so an order can actually, so you can get a better, tighter spread at the top of the book. And then it just sort of executes across the depth of the book. So
yeah, that's right.
Makes a ton of sense.
And just to add on to that, I would say a lot of small exchanges, like their starting order books are completely empty. So, it's kind of like if you're a new exchange for the first time, there's nothing on the order book at all. Having some orders is better than no orders. And the second thing is that
having been the general counsel of an exchange, I can tell you that the mantra is always liquidity begets liquidity. And of course, then how do you get liquidity? It's like, I don't know. But if you get liquidity, you'll get liquidity. But if you don't have liquidity, you don't get liquidity.
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing I'll point out
is this is a way of bootstrapping.
Exactly. It's a bootstrapping liquidity method. But the other thing is that a lot of small exchanges aren't directly competing with Binance or FTX because a lot of them are. Like local exchanges, like IndoDAX in Indonesia or PDAX in the Philippines, that are only available to the local residents of that country. A lot of fiat-based exchanges are like that. So in some ways, their audience, their user base is very different from the global Binance user base. But they still need an algorithm, some type of technology that allows them to automatically place orders on the order book, adjust them as markets move around, and also make some money from doing so because they can post wider spreads and hedge tighter and actually clip an arbitrage profit from any fills.
Right. And they're providing, and we'll get into this, they're providing a market clearing function, a valuable market clearing function. So, the arbitrageurs in this case are actually performing a positive service. I mean, you can make a case sometimes they don't, but in this case, they're clearly providing a positive service because they're providing that depth of liquidity that otherwise doesn't exist and provides a competitive marketplace for it. So
that's right.
Yeah. Spot on. Awesome. So I guess, we'll keep rolling through here. So, let's talk a little bit about, because we were talking a lot about market making and also arb trading, and there's distinctions, right? So there's, in the in a regulated market like the US market, you have registered market makers. And part of becoming a market maker, you have certain privileges that are associated with being the market maker. You may get different positioning when an order comes in for a book. You may get certain feeds that you wouldn't normally get. There are certain advantages that you get, or else you wouldn't want to become a market maker. You would just have all the burden of being a market maker and none of the benefits. So that's the purpose of market making. Those benefits are typically accorded by a traditional exchange. And so in the context of a digital asset marketplace, those benefits, there's still benefits, but they're not as developed. Liquidity is more bifurcated. Maybe that those benefits aren't as concentrated as they are in the US markets. But do you want to maybe talk about the distinction between market making and arb trading, you know, as opposed to like a traditional US based market?
Yeah, definitely. So the way I explain this is that I think the nuance that I think your viewers should appreciate is in my opinion, the key difference between traditional kind of equity exchange in the US and a digital asset exchange, to me, is a term called direct market access. And what that refers to is that in a traditional equities exchange, typically the market makers, the folks who can actually have access to the order book, who can place orders onto it, are only they call it designated market makers. And this history really stems from how the New York Stock Exchange and the original equity exchange were actually formed. Because they were actually formed by the market makers themselves. Before the NYSE was started, it was a bunch of people on the street, outside Wall Street, on Wall Street, basically, you know, waving their billets around, getting people to trade with them. And then one day they said, you know, why are we standing out here? It's really cold. We're all decentralized and no one can find us. Why don't we rent a building and all operate together? And so everyone can come in and trade with us on the floor of a building. And that became the NYSE. So because the market makers were the ones who set up the original US exchanges, they clearly did not have a huge incentive to let other people, you know, market make onto their order book. And so that's why the concept of specialists, which turned into DMMs or designated market makers, has always been a feature of US equities exchanges. So that's why, you know, you market makers have certain privileges, but also means that no one else besides the market makers have those privileges, can actually access the order book. And this has actually created a bunch of scandals in the history of the New York Stock Exchange and led to lots of, you know, regulations. But overall, it's a highly regulated market, which is also why it's standardized and works very well for the immature equities market. When digital assets exchanges came around, I think the first Wild West was Mt. Gox back in 2012, 2013. And every single year since then, there have been more and more digital asset crypto exchanges being produced. And that's really because digital asset exchanges are just a computer program running on a server. It's a server that allows people to connect to a server via API. And people connected via API can basically access the order book, place orders, take orders, and just interact, you know. And so in some ways, my view is that digital asset exchanges are much more of a pure exchange. It's almost analogous to how ad tech exchanges work, where it's a free open marketplace. Everyone can connect to it programmatically via API or via the user interface and post orders and take orders. But overall, I think the key difference between a digital asset exchange and a traditional equity exchange is really about direct market access. Right now, every single crypto exchange has open APIs that are free, free data feeds. And so in my opinion, for small trading firms and for individuals, it's a more level playing field. And there's also just more opportunities available than if you have to go through a designated market maker in the case of equities.
Right. And so in that context, you still need market makers though, right? That's the thing. Like, you know, somebody, right. You know, that market clearing function, that liquidity provision, the stability mechanisms, you know, arbitrage traders provide that. But particularly when you have an ICO, an initial offering, you know, then it's more important than ever, to ensure that there's some stability. Otherwise, you might just say, okay, we're public, and oh crap, now we're zero, and we're actually, we have more headaches today than we did than when we went public, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And actually, the one thing I would point out is that I think the way the market makers operate today is that they do both market making, providing liquidity, and they do arbitrage, typically in the same strategy.
Right.
And the reason is because they're not playing a single exchange game. They're playing a multi-exchange game. So typically as a market maker, the way you operate is you have certain assets, you have a pool of assets, and your goal is to take those assets and place them on different exchanges. Those exchanges might be centralized exchanges like Binance, or they might be decentralized exchanges on the sitting of blockchain. But in either case, there's an opportunity cost for me in terms of which exchange I place my assets on, or I guess which chains in the case of DEXs. But the strategies I pursue are fairly similar in each one. I can do single venue market making, in which I'm kind of placing a two-way bid and offer spread on one exchange, hoping that the market stays range bound, in which case, you know, the market goes back and forth. I buy low and sell high at one exchange. But obviously, I'm incurring risk by that strategy. So I can also do arbitrage, where I have some assets on one exchange, some assets on another exchange, and then when prices deviate on those two exchanges, I buy low and sell high. I make money from arbitrage. But I can also do a combination of the two. So cross-exchange market making is a combination of the two, where you're making a market on one exchange. As you get filled, you hedge on another exchange. And so it's kind of like, I would say, the traditional view of market making is that you're providing liquidity to a market, you're sitting there and you're taking risk, and every single time the market moves up or down, you might lose money. So market makers tend to, the traditional view is you either place liquidity, but when times are volatile, you step back, you kind of like widen your spreads, or even you stop providing liquidity altogether. But in the more kind of like the more sophisticated quant trading view of market making, you have your assets on a bunch of different exchanges, you're hedging your risk across each one, and you're just looking for opportunities to make small amounts of money by arbitrage, by providing liquidity and hedging. You're monitoring your overall inventory across all exchanges from an overall risk perspective.
Right. But in a traditional market, you know, when a market maker, particularly with a initial offering, you know, they are going to have, they are generally going to get additional benefit, maybe directly from the issuer, to sort of sit in front of an oncoming truck, you know, or to make sure that the oncoming truck doesn't run over. And that's part of widening your spreads too, because like if you're fighting, you know, and it's all part of the strategy. Like if you're trying to keep an aggressive quote, and you have to keep on jumping back, then you could burn a lot of capital where you might just be better off just sort of like sticking your stake at the one price and saying it doesn't go below here. And we come in with size if it starts to move. I mean, there's so many different ways to cut it up. You can't even summarize it, but
I totally agree. If you're market making for a brand new asset, it's the first time this asset has ever been traded publicly, then yes, you're taking a lot of risk, because there's no information on how that asset will trade, and you can't hedge that risk on another venue by doing some type of cross-exchange strategy. So absolutely, the very first time an asset is being listed, the market maker is taking a ton of risk. And that's why in traditional equities markets, you know, there's all this, like there's a roadshow before the asset, you know, is listed, where there's a lot of price guidance, a lot of like research, and that all that is a process designed to give the market and the market makers information on how to, you know, provide liquidity for the asset over time.
Right. And then once you get past that initial stage in the crypto space or digital asset space, I mean, in many ways, if you're like, you're a market maker, if you're on both sides of the quote, I suppose that's one way of saying it's a market making strategy. You're both sides of the quote. And if you're going across trades, exchanges, it's an arb strategy. But in that case, it's a market making type strategy versus, I mean, you may or may not be acting as a market maker. You could be just saying, that's my strategy. I'm like, that's how I'm making money, versus a market maker, which is like a DMM designated, you have a specific function to provide liquidity on both sides of the quote, you know, and within certain parameters. I mean, to your point, even sometimes your designated market maker is like, yeah, I'm making your market. And if the market goes haywire, they widen their quotes and just like, what? You're not really my market maker anymore. Yeah, you're like, you know, your spread is like meaningless. Like you're giving me no support. Yes. You're just moving the quote all the way down and staying wide. Those are crappy market makers. It's like, you know, we're a designated market. Right. We're a designated market maker, but we'll just widen our spreads and just walk you all the way down and not really provide that liquidity. Like, oh yeah, they got the back end liquidity, but you know, it's, you know, the depth of book liquidity, like the way deep liquidity, you know, that doesn't really make a difference if you're like,
You point out a really, this is actually one big issue because, and I call this, it's really about kind of like it's really the principal agent problem because, you know, as a token issuer, typically it's actually the tokens that are hiring the market makers today because they're coming out for the first time, they're listing on exchange, and they you know, because their asset is completely unknown, they need to hire a service provider to provide liquidity to the token that enables people to actually trade their token when it's listed. And so they end up hiring a market-making firm, and these are hedge funds, essentially, like Jump Capital, Wintermute, or GSR are some of the larger ones. But these play the same role as Citadel or Virtu in traditional markets where they are, and what they're supposed to do is they're supposed to actually provide liquidity to a token. And they're supposed to adhere to certain obligations. Like I'm going to provide this much depth with this much at this type of spread. And I'm going to guarantee something like 95% uptime. But here's what happens because what the market maker is doing is placing orders on the order book. And the customer, the token issuer, typically has no visibility into what the market maker is doing other than this monthly report they're getting at the end of the month. In addition, the model that a lot of these market makers use is something called the option model, where they get an option to, because they also need tokens in order to actually provide their services. The token issuer gives them a bunch of their tokens, and a bunch of Bitcoin or Ethereum or stablecoin to provide the other side of the trade. And the market maker is taking the issuer's assets and providing liquidity with those assets. And the market maker is incentivized by having essentially a call option where they can essentially keep the tokens and give back the initial dollar amounts, keep the tokens as their fee. So what happens, what has actually happened is that the market makers have because they can price that option better than their customers can, because the market makers are hedge funds, they have basically figured out ways to essentially make a lot of money if the token price goes up. Because if the token price goes up, the market maker just exercises the option, takes all the tokens, and they can, keep it. But if the token price goes down, the market maker doesn't lose anything because they can just give the tokens back to the issuer. And so unfortunately it creates a perverse incentive for the market makers. Also, because they don't have to, they don't have to report. They just report once a month. A lot of the market makers, the top firms don't do this, but there's a long tail of fairly, shady market makers that frankly just keep the tokens when the market goes up, and when the market goes down, they just stop providing liquidity because they don't have an incentive to keep on doing their job. So this is actually, and I think the kind of the opacity and the shadiness of the industry, this is actually another reason why we open source Hummingbot. Because we saw this happening, this has been happening for years and years. And a lot of our token projects were frankly who my friends who were, startup founders trying to create new Web3 business models, trying to create crypto projects that were trying to do the right thing. A lot of them I felt were being taken advantage of by these hedge funds who understood finance better than they could. And when markets went up, the market maker, made a lot of money off the token project. And when markets went down, the market makers just didn't even do their job. So I felt that by open sourcing this tool, that it will allow people to do market making for themselves or allow new market making firms to enter the industry, it would kind of open up the market and decentralize this, very opaque industry.
Right. And Hummingbot also has some programs where it encourages like the Hummingbot users themselves to to act in that market making role. And it could be used, like, I think, you know, sporadically, it could be used, you know, various times to provide liquidity, stability. Why don't you talk a little bit about that and how that's worked out?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So remember when I said that, you know, our VCs were asking us how we're going to make money off this, of this open source software. And so when we first launched HummingBot in 2019, we didn't really know how to do it. So after a few months, we started to figure out that, you know, we had this growing community of people, both individuals and small trading firms, who were using HummingBot to basically provide liquidity, sometimes for their own projects, sometimes, you know, just as to make money. And then on the other side, we knew a bunch of token projects who were trying to find an alternative to hiring Jump or GSR as market makers. And so we thought, what if we could like create some type of community-based model where people could run HummingBot and earn some type of reward for providing liquidity, and the reward would allow the token issuers to basically get liquidity for their tokens, for their markets, without having to sign up and be dedicated to one single market-making firm. So we wrote a white paper in October 2019, and the title was Liquidity Mining, a marketplace-based method of compensating market makers. So this was a pretty technical white paper because we outlined a mathematical model where you could take a reward pool and allocate that according to different order book snapshots. So the idea was, if you took an order book, you could see, you know, where all the orders were on that order book. And let's say you could take a random snapshot on average every minute on that order book. If you knew whose orders were in the order book, you could basically allocate a small reward every minute to people based on how tight their orders were and how large their orders were. So we're actually using some of the same kind of contracts that market makers were basically using in terms of adhering to certain spread, uptime, and depth obligations. But we were trying to create a decentralized model where it's like almost like anyone can compete to provide that liquidity. And so the way we thought about it was, as a liquidity provider, I'm earning a yield based on the capital I'm putting in, based on the liquidity I'm putting in. And then for the token issuer, I'm seeing a reduction in slippage based on the orders. I can kind of mathematically measure all of this. So as a side note, I think this was actually the impetus for the term liquidity mining in the crypto industry, which has unfortunately ballooned into like, you know, into a much, you know, much larger and frankly, a much, you know, sketchier type of activity that happens on DEXs and everything else. So we've actually stopped using the liquidity mining term. However, the platform that we created as a product of this, which is called HummingBot Miner, is still around. And every day we have thousands of people running bots, thousands of bots providing liquidity to dozens of individual markets. So right now, I think if you look at the Miner platform, currently there are 1,092 bots providing $314,000 of liquidity to about 50 different individual markets on four exchanges. So for example, Avalanche is one of our customers.
You said $314,000?
Dollars of liquidity, yeah.
You said $314,000?
Yes. So the amount of liquidity is not that much. But the reason why it's effective is because it's really serving the long tail of markets. So for instance, we have about 50 different markets on the Miner platform. The average amount of liquidity in each one is ranges from 5,000 to 25,000, provided by, you know, 10 to 20 bots each. But because these are like smaller markets, like XCAD USDT on KuCoin or Front BUSD on Binance, and our customers are the token issuers themselves, or on Sendex, we have a bunch of campaigns as well. It allows individuals running HummingBot to kind of like put their capital at risk to earn kind of like token rewards paid from the token issuers. And the token issuers, for them, it's an alternative to hiring a single hedge fund. Now they're getting access to a wider community of people providing liquidity. So in some ways, it's not just a liquidity provision function, but also a distribution and marketing function, you know, at the same time. So a lot of our customers like Avalanche, iExec, Front, they also hire market maker as well. you know, in addition to using the Miner platform to get community, basically.
Right. And 314,000, the impact of it is magnified, obviously, if it just keeps on refreshing, right?
That's right.
You know, execution refresh, and it just may be reflective of the market. Market starts to get bigger, start bigger names, it grows and contracts. And so I totally get that. It's magnified in its importance.
Yeah.
And so this basically allows an issuer, like, doing, depending on the platform that they're going to be working with, if they have a relationship with Humming Matter, or I guess even if they don't, they could actually, leverage this pool where market makers could provide stability for their project. They could even assess what kind of, you could have different rewards programs, et cetera. You can gauge how much depth of book you're going to get, responsiveness, and then you've got another source of liquidity stability for your project when you launch, and a diversity of that, so you're not dependent on one person suddenly ghosting you and like, oh no.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And our goal was really trying to create a two-sided marketplace. So kind of take the Uber concept or the Airbnb concept and apply it to market making so that people, can provide liquidity on one side, on the supply side, and on the demand side, whether the exchange or the token issuer, they can access the marketplace to get liquidity instead of being constrained to a single provider.
Right. And this definitely serves a different purpose than like AMMs as currently utilized.
That's a great question, because I view AMMs as a different exchange model. So just like you have the order book model on centralized exchanges, the AMM model is kind of like a different exchange model. But ultimately, exchanges are always... it's always still, you need both makers and takers to make the exchange work. So what's interesting is that on the order book side, because you have retail people coming in and buying and selling, those people are dependent on orders on the order book. And those orders on the order book, you have to have a bot basically that's constantly refreshing them. The need is for makers. However, for AMMs, the inverse is true in that and AMM, it's easy as a liquidity provider. You can almost like be a retail liquidity provider by just depositing your tokens into the AMM and earning a yield for providing liquidity. But a lot of AMMs have a dearth of actual takers. They have a dearth of arbitrage bots that are coming in to take the other side. We're actually about to kind of launch an experiment with Avalanche where we're going to incentivize the same types of, basically get people to also run bots, except people are running arbitrage bots and providing the volume that allows kind of Avalanche-based DEXs to, thrive and get more volume and kind of fill the missing gap, which is on the taker side as opposed to the maker side.
Interesting. So I was I was general counsel of a direct edge exchange for a number of years and also did some ATS stuff. But I remember just, the whole maker taker price incentivization model, that was like, that was an art form. Like we had different exchange platforms with different maker taker ratios. Sometimes it'd be you're negative on one, you're positive on the other, and it would attract very different types of liquidity. Some would be more retail focused, some would be more hedge fund focused, So it's just, it is an art form. And I remember there was one guy in our shop, he was like the artist. Like he would know incremental pennies and understand. Right. It was very complicated. It wasn't just like saying, oh, we're going to put a number here, we're going to put a number there. It was like, no, we're going to tick it up by like a quarter of a cent on one store or one basis point or whatever. It was just nuts. So that wasn't a quarter of a cent. That actually was a lot for a share.
And building on your point, I think that I think the overarching thesis, and this is why I'm so excited about HummingBot, is that it's kind of like, basically, it goes to that theme of direct market access. It's kind of like if anyone can create an exchange, you have all these different exchange models proliferating, but all these different exchange models require, makers and takers for them to actually function. And so what ends up happening is that our product, HummingBot, is kind of like a piece of software that matches the long tail of exchanges with the long tail of both individual and professional trading firms that are looking to operate and make money off these small exchanges. Because our users on the user side, they're typically not the retail Coinbase, folks who just like to click around and punt on, like goblin profile pick NFTs. Instead, they're the people who, you know, as you said, like they study exchanges. And they really like, you know, get off on the fact that they spend hours like figuring out like some minor rebate on one exchange, and they set up an arbitrage bot that allows them to, you know, make 10%, you know, like per month on the capital for a while, and then that opportunity expires, and they have to go and find more opportunities like that. So it kind of like appeals to this, like, you know, the engineer slash trader persona that almost approaches trading as like a, like playing RPG, like playing a game, as opposed to, you know, something that they have to do.
Yeah, right on. That's so and we touched here on the community. So let's talk about the community for Hummingbot. Mm-hmm. You've described it as, I guess, maybe not some cases full-time trader, sometimes mm-hmm. just somebody who comes home and just it's another really exciting way to play and make money in a much more structured way. Arguably, if they get it right, there's much less risk. It's like you figure out the game, you can make the money without the risk because you're providing that market clearing function, and you're not exposing yourself on one side or the other. What are the benefits that they get as being part of the Hummingbot community? Like, is there more that they like? Describe what it's like to be that user and what you gain out of it.
Yeah. So. On the community side, this really stems from kind of the history of open source projects, which open source hasn't been a huge part of finance, but it's been an incredibly massive and large part of Silicon Valley for the last 20 years. And our inspiration has really been projects like Linux or Apache Spark, which have basically created large community-based ways of maintaining a certain software code base. So, for example, Linux, when Linux first launched in the early 90s, it was basically this command line clone, Linux, like a Unix clone that was really hard to use. But if you're a Linux user today, you have this incredibly powerful graphical interface that's almost indistinguishable from Windows or Mac. And it's because over the last 30 years, this community of people have contributed lots of different things completely for free, you know, into Linux. Like different drivers, different pieces of software, like packages, and they can do that because Linux has a very modular architecture, and there's a really vibrant open source community of developers who are contributing to it. So we designed Hummingbot in a similar fashion. So the different components are we have different connectors to exchanges. We have centralized exchange connectors, and we have decentralized exchange connectors. And then in addition, we have strategies that people can contribute that that allow them to basically do various things on those exchanges. And we just introduced a new component called scripts that are like light versions of strategies, just like snippets of Python code that are simpler for people to create. And so because we have these different kind of components, we try to give incentives. Well, when we first started, people just contributed these things for free. But today, because we have an open source foundation with a governance token, we can use a token to kind of create incentives for developers to come in, contribute different components in, and also to maintain those different components. That's just a recap. So today, I think we have about 30 official centralized exchange connectors. We just started the decentralized exchange connectors, so we have like 5 or 10 of those, and we have about 15 to 16 different strategies in our code base. But we expect these numbers to exponentially increase over the next few years as kind of like the system kind of grows, and as kind of like the HBOT token incentive model continues to mature. And we believe that over the long term, Hummingbot will look something like Linux, a community-based project that allows any trader to do any trading strategy on any exchange.
Excellent. And while we're talking about that, let's talk a little bit about maybe institutions' usage of the platform. Now, I think it's really designed more for the institutions. They tend to have a very proprietary view of the strategy that they develop. Like the game is like, hey, if I develop this phenomenal strategy, then the value is that nobody else has it. Although, you know, realistically, there's probably some components of that just make it easier for others. And maybe by being part of the community, they could benefit, or they could even leverage like benchmarking components of the community. Is that so? You know, what's your thoughts on that kind of engagement and the value to sophisticated institutions?
Yeah, yeah. When we first started, most of our users were individual. But over time, we've seen a greater number of institutional usage. And they use it a lot of times, they're only using certain components they need. For example, exchange connectors. So a lot of time, they'll just use the connectors. So they don't have to skip, they can skip the integration with exchanges, but they're adding their own strategies and keeping those private. In addition, a lot of them do use our strategies, but because our strategies are kind of programs with different parameters, they can keep their configuration files secret, you know, while just using the open source software. So right now, a number of the market making, larger market making firms in crypto are actually running their businesses on top of us. So some of the names I can name are System9, 3Jane Capital, CTF. These are kind of like public names. And we think also there's a long tail of other firms that, you know, are just using our code for free, not reporting any volume into us and just keeping up with the updates quietly. But overall, we don't mind that because I think that's part of being open source software. And the way we look at it is, you know, there's many protocols, there's many exchanges out there. But Hummingbot, if we're the largest open source ecosystem, and we connect to all the exchanges, all the protocols, over time, as long as we can, you know, build a sustainable ecosystem, as long as we can kind of continue to make money off of the exchange partnerships, as long as we can continue to get the token out there and allow people to actually govern the project, over time, you know, we do look like something like Linux, you know, whereas it's an open source client software that allows people to kind of like interact with all the protocols and exchanges out there.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, longer term, the incentive for these sophisticated institutions, even if they want to retain their proprietary code, like the benchmarking component of it could be significant. Like, hey, I developed a strategy. You could utilize some of the benchmarking components. You could have different traders also trying to break it or trade against it or create volume on a benchmarking strategy. I mean, you know, in terms of making it the core piece of your value add, your alpha, I mean, there's you could leverage a lot of testing resources effectively and say, hey, I got the strategy, and like, you know, maybe put it in a sandbox and let others just go to town without necessarily revealing the whole code. To me, that seems like a, you know, there's definitely something there, because I can't imagine, like, you know, because institutional traders, like, you know, they got all these guys that are focused, like if they're really smart, they're trying to create that alpha. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but who's doing the testing, right? Like I've been a lot of organizations. You're like that. Everybody who wants to move to where their value creation is, and then when it comes to the benchmarking side, they're like, oh, well, you know, we'll create this other unit or something. Right. But it doesn't always have, or you have the guys who are creating it also create the testing, which isn't really the kind of diversity you want in testing it. You want to like get people jazzed who are from the outside and saying, yeah, I'll beat these guys. Yeah. You know, I'm gonna break their, you know, and that's where you get really some. You know, that's how you have like more rigor to your benchmark testing, right? Yeah. As opposed to just even,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And just building on your point, people may not be aware that a lot of the key strategies in quant trading are actually public because they're based on an academic paper that was, you know, was written, and the paper kind of outlines the main model for the strategy. So for example, one of the strategies we're most proud of is called Avalanada. And it's based on probably the most classic paper in market making by a folks named Marco Avellaneda, who unfortunately just passed away earlier this year, and Sasha Stoikov. So Avellaneda and Stoikov are two of the most like kind of, you know, famous kind of academics in quant finance. They and a bunch of their peers have written papers that describe like kind of like models for market making, models for arbitrage, and basically kind of apply a very, you know, theoretical academic treatment toward market making. However, until we came along, there were no public GitHub repositories that actually outlined how you actually ran the model and actually parameterized it and actually ran a program against it. And so we spent a lot of time to kind of model the Avalanada strategy both in the pure mathematical form, but also creating kind of easy to use parameters like spread that allows individuals to like, you know, use that model without having to understand all the math behind it. So, and I think that's an area of research and development that we would love to work with more professional trading firms on, because essentially the Avanada, there's other papers like Gwent, you know, the newer models coming out of kind of like Chicago and Stanford that I think, you know, are really interesting to model. And so in the future, as Hummingbot develops, we hope to work with universities, you know, trading firms and other research organizations to just basically expose and make more public how quant finance actually works under the hood.
Excellent, excellent. So, and so we talked a little bit about AMMs and centralized exchanges. And you, it's, you know, yours is sort of like a different take, right? Because it's almost like DeFi, like, you know, right? It's not DeFi per se, but it's decentralization, bringing the power of decentralization, you know, a decentralized community to a more centralized system to kind of, you know, facilitate that. And I think you said you're also now considering how do we also use that from the other side of a DeFi. So, one point that we had talked about too is that on exchanges, the use of Hummingbot would also substantially reduce conflicts of interest. So if an exchange is providing liquidity or has an arm that provides liquidity or an associated firm, there are potential conflicts of interest in terms of access to books and, you know, is it, you know, what kind of access are they getting? Is it preferential? Are they getting, you know, is it actually being used against it? But again, by sort of opening it up to this broader community with a lot of different competing interests, it sort of it reduces the ability that any one, you know, centralized market maker with preferential access or somehow related to the exchange where it's being listed might have.
Yeah, that's right. And so we talked a lot of exchanges, and in my view, a lot of exchanges, you know, they're just startups trying to do the right thing. And because it's an unregulated industry, a lot of them, I would say, you know, the reason that a lot of them, some of them provide their own liquidity, they run their own market making, a lot of times it's because there's a dearth of market makers out there, and they can't hire or find enough market makers. So they're almost forced to providing liquidity as a way to operate their business. But obviously that creates conflicts of interest with their users. And as the industry gets more regulated, I think we'll see provisions in place that basically say, you know, if you're running exchange, you have to leverage external market makers and you can't be trading your own book. So I think it's a good thing for the industry because, you know, if there are more tooling out there like Hummingbot, there's more market makers who can access the order book. And I think there's an advantage in having, this free and open marketplace where, you know, it's anyone can provide liquidity, anyone can take liquidity, and the exchange is basically, you know, it's just a flea market that makes money by connecting both the providers of liquidity and the takers of liquidity in that venue. So I think that right now, I think obviously the market is still very much Wild West, but over time, you know, and I think that the advantage of this model, frankly, in my opinion, versus a traditional model where only certain people can create exchanges, only certain people can provide liquidity, is that you see a lot more variation in terms of the types of innovation that happens. So right now, obviously, we have the AMM, which was a new type of exchange that, you know, really seemed to work. Another invention that was created by crypto was perpetual future, which because it allows people to create derivatives that don't have expiration dates, it don't have strike prices, and avoids all this like complication that exists in traditional instruments. And we're also seeing the same thing being applied to options now. And so it's kind of like, in my opinion, a lot of things that happen to finance are because people have always done things the way that they used to. And there's kind of like because people aren't able to create these new financial primitives, a lack of innovation has perpetuated the industry for the last hundreds of years. And it wasn't really until people started to basically create these new designs on the blockchain, you know, figure out if they work or not, and just, you know, basically, you know, allow traders and developers to code against it, that we're finally seeing innovation being unlocked in finance. And so that's what's important to me. It's not so much whether it's centralized or decentralized, but it's not like, you know, what are the new models coming out? You know, and are there people who are able to kind of solve the chicken egg problem by providing liquidity, taking liquidity, and just seeing if these new primitives and new exchange models actually work.
Excellent. So a couple things I want to cover. One is I want to touch on sort of the current environment, right? So in the current environment, you know, maybe there's trends that you're seeing. Certainly, you know, I know in traditional equities, you know, when you start to get a lot of volatility in the market, you typically would see market makers widen their spreads, which could be equivalent to even not being there at all, just pulling it off the table because they're just like, okay, I'm going to go when I understand the market a little bit better. I want that sort of steady state. I don't trade, you know, there's vol trades. Like market makers, you would call them volatility traders. Are you seeing like a shift toward other strategies? Like, for example, oftentimes a volatility trade is like an ignition or momentum based strategy, you know, as opposed to a market making. Have you seen that kind of shift amongst the strategies being used or asked for or discussions, or how has that sort of played out on your end?
I would say, I think there is some of that going on because but the way I look at it is more around, I think that this is also caveated by the fact that our users are the long tail. So our users are not, you know, just providing, you know, millions of dollars of liquidity to the Bitcoin pairs and Binance. You know, they're really looking for like, you know, opportunities to be like big fish in small ponds, you know, kind of market make for small tokens on small exchanges. So what I see from our community is that a lot of them are looking at the interplay between centralized exchanges and decentralized exchanges for small tokens. Because what happens today is that, you know, in the past, before decentralized exchanges came along, a small token would have to list, you know, and pay a lot of money to market maker to list on a centralized exchange. But today, a lot of them list on a decentralized exchange, like Uniswap, PancakeSwap on Binance Smart Chain, or Trader Joe on Avalanche. And then that's the first step. And then afterwards, they're listing on a centralized exchange as a second step. So what that means is as a market maker, you always have two markets you can kind of like play between, the centralized markets for a token and the decentralized markets for a token. And so because the decentralized markets rely on arbitrage, so anytime the centralized exchange moves, it creates an arbitrage opportunity between that and the decentralized exchange. Meanwhile, because you already have the decentralized exchange there, you kind of already have some history for the token before it hits the central exchange. And so, and this is also why at Hummingbot, we've really prioritized adding decentralized exchange connectors so that our users can basically provide liquidity on both centralized and decentralized exchanges while hedging on the other side.
Excellent. And then I guess the last thing is just what are your short to medium term goals for Hummingbot? I think you touched on some of them, but maybe we just sort of summarize them directionally.
So I would say like the first thing is I would say I think that, you know, we just launched the Hummingbot Foundation, which is an open source. It's kind of like modeled after Linux Foundation. It's an open source foundation that's the steward of the Hummingbot project. So the goal there, and that's also what the part that I'm more involved in, because we've separated the business from the for-profit liquidity provision service side, which is Coin Alpha, from the open source side, which is Hummingbot. On the open source side, our main goal is to expand our community on both the exchange side and on the user side. We're still entering into partnerships with different exchanges, both centralized and decentralized, so that our users can actually supply more liquidity and volume to the exchanges and do more programs. Some of the programs we're launching, we're actually launching something called a bot camp, a developer boot camp that teaches people how to write Hummingbot strategies and also teach them how to actually do quant trading from a theory standpoint as well. And so developers who pass the course will get some HBOT tokens, but we're also give them a certificate as an NFT that allows them to kind of like, you know, basically take that certificate and hopefully, you know, be hired by others in the community to build, you know, different integrations or different strategies itself. So overall, I would say on the Hummingbot Foundation side, we're kind of like, we're just basically using this single piece of software, the single code base to try to expand, you know, on the exchange side, as well as the developer slash trader side. But overall, it's only been a few months, but I think the model is working. And the main thing we have to figure out, honestly, is how to add more documentation, how to coordinate all the moving pieces that go into maintaining a global 20,000, you know, member community, and just trying to make sure that basically we can match the developers looking to write strategies, the traders looking to use them, and exchanges who benefit from all this liquidity and volume.
Excellent. So before we break, anything that I should have asked that I neglected to?
No, I think this was an incredibly fruitful conversation. Hopefully it was educational for your audience. And the only thing I should mention is that in addition to running the Humming Up, kind of like, being a board member of Humming Up Foundation, I started a Substack recently. And my goal of my Substack is to try to educate people on how, finance works, and how crypto works to people in finance, and try to bridge the gap, because I feel like there's a lot of misunderstanding out there about what the technology of crypto really is on the finance side. And then on the crypto side, I think people don't understand kind of like how, exchanges and other financial, how the finance industry works. And I think, in my opinion, crypto is really the synthesis of kind of like the blockchain world and the finance world. And eventually, we'll all be in the same finance industry. So it's a good time that I think everyone learns about how it works. And so I would encourage people to just check out my Substack. It's Faintality, Fang, T-A-L-I-T-Y, like the Mortal Kombat, thing. But anyway, so it's faintality.substack.com. And I'm just trying to teach people how it all works.
Awesome. Good stuff. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. This was great.
Thanks, Eric.